the show.
Well, hey, everyone, and welcome to this week's show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson. Here in the studio, we've got a great show for you today. First of all, you're going to want to hear our inbox segment later on because we have our own Wade Brown from our Pastoral Ministries Department. He is going to be chatting with a listener about deciding marriage based on denomination. This guy wants to marry someone, but they have some deep denominational differences. So I'm going to have to ask Wade how to deal with that. And he does a great job of doing it. For our culture segment, we're doing something that we have not done before, specifically because this week is Veterans Day. You have heard our own Dave Sockheld read some stuff in the past. For the 4th, he read the Declaration of Independence once, and then he has read Lincoln's Proclamation for Thanksgiving. This time around, we are going to celebrate Veterans Day. And Dave is going to read MacArthur's farewell speech to the cadets at West Point from 1962. So a very inspiring speech that I think y'all will enjoy. I mean, we know that you guys love history and we know that you love being in touch, but most of all, we really focus on mentoring a lot here at The Boundless Show. And so we think that this will be a great piece for you to hear. But for our roundtable today, speaking of mentoring, we thought it would be great to bring in a few folks who have been there, done that, hopefully not done too much, or, you know, we'll see as we start talking. But we are going to talk about letters to our former selves. If we, where we are right now, were able to write a letter to the people that we were in the past, what would we say to them? Both practical advice, maybe some life lessons learned, things we'd do differently, things we would risk more, things that we wouldn't worry about, all that kind of stuff. So I want to introduce Mr. Bill Spencer. Bill, welcome.
Thank you.
Bill is one of our national reps for family policy councils through CitizenLink, which is an affiliate of Focus on the Family here at Focus, otherwise known as really a public policy effort that Focus on the Family is associated with. So, Bill, great to have you as a part of the discussion. We have Yvette Marr. Yvette, welcome.
Hi there.
Yvette is our senior communication specialist, which just a bit,
what does
apparently
that mean,
it encompasses a bunch of, stuff. That's what we're saying.
Good intro.
So Yvette is also the host of Your Family Live, which is a weekly webcast that we have. So make sure that you check that out. I know we've mentioned it before, but you can find out about it at yourfamilylive.com. Also at focusonthefamily.com if you need to search or whatever as you're surfing around, but make sure that you check that out. And then Gary Schneeberger, he has been here before, but he is back again. Gary, welcome.
Great to be back again.
Gary is our Vice President of Communications here at Focus on the Family, which encompasses everything from media and public relations to managing our social media and some of the other things that we have going on when it comes to communicating with those outside of our ministry and how we go about crafting that message. So welcome. I also need to give a special holla to Evan and Jeannie Peterson, who are visiting us today here in the studio. They are watching from the other side of the glass. They are here on their honeymoon and decided to include The Boundless Show on their trip. Very exciting, because they used Boundless Show topics as discussion starters in their relationship. So we are very much assured that if you do that, you will have a successful marriage. So plan on doing that, those of you that are moving to marriage, and please tell us about it. And if you're ever out here, make sure that you stop and visit.
Are you sure you don't want to bring them in here and take us out? Because they're probably a lot more interesting than we're going to be.
Well, you know, they're youngish, though. They're starting out, so they probably haven't made too many mistakes yet. So
that means, folks,
they have been there, done that stuff.
That means that we're oldish, yes. I think, is what Lisa's saying.
Seasoned.
We need
going
to, you know,
seasoned.
We need to talk to those who, you know, have navigated some roads here. So, so as we do that, let's go ahead and get started. And I want each of you, maybe just, we'll just go down the line and just give a brief, like, you know, 30 seconds or less, synopsis of your life, kind of, so that we can have it as context for what we're going to be sharing here. So just, you know, diagram your life for us briefly so we kind of know who you are and kind of that context from which you'll be speaking. So, Bill, why don't you go ahead and start?
Well, I appreciate you let me contribute first because clearly being the oldest person here, I might forget. So let me just say that I was born and raised in Central Virginia and then joined the Air Force after high school. Went to trade school across the street here at the United States Air Force Academy and spent nearly 29 years as a reconnaissance pilot, primarily before I was replaced by a satellite in the United States Air Force, and retired in 2004, taught high school for a couple of years, and then felt the Lord calling me here to work in the public policy area of Focus on the Family, where we've been here for the last 4 years.
Awesome. Okay. Bill's a great guy. I like calling him Mr. Bill, FYI. So when I see him, I'm always like, Mr. Bill. And he always asks me how I'm doing. So I appreciate that. All right, Yvette.
Wow, 30 seconds.
Yeah.
I am the poster child for grace. There's my 30-second synopsis of my life. Been at Focus on the Family for 19 years and lived my Christian life growing up here at Focus on the Family. And so I truly do look at my life and think, wow, that the Lord would allow me to step up to any platform, microphone, or face-to-face with anyone and utter his name is a shock to me and most everyone who knew me before I came to Christ. So that's the synopsis. Married with three children and a grandchild and another one on the way, and just excited to be able to share and look back over what I would have done differently.
All right. Gary.
30 seconds. I just clear my throat in 30 seconds. Unchurched home, grew up in, embraced the unchurchedness of it, lived my life as what my wife called a smarmy reprobate. Came to Christ in 1997. Miraculously enough, as a journalist, I was a journalist working in Palm Springs, California, and I was 32 years old. Not exactly Saul to Paul, but pretty close in terms of unlikelihood. Came to Focus in 2000, so I've been here 10 years, and I still, like a vet, am amazed that the guy who I was 15 years ago is now a guy who speaks on behalf of a Christian organization, let alone one as influential as Focus on the Family.
All right. And just to provide context, since we're an audio show, I mean, I don't want you to feel obligated to like throw your age out there, but we're talking about, I'm in my 30s, Gary, 40s.
Well, no, okay, you can throw my age out there.
Okay. That makes perfect sense. I was really playing this game right now.
Well, I mean,
really?
That is sitting next to me very nervous right now.
Okay, we're going.
That's okay. That's right.
I'd like to skip that question. Go to Bill.
It can't be more than 57 years. That's for
I am.
Sure.
Yeah, I am indeed in my 40s. I just turned 45. When I told my wife I was now halfway to 50, she said, "No, you're halfway to 90."
Yeah, smarmy, reprobate.
Yep, exactly.
I'm 48, and I really don't mind telling it, because the wrinkles on my face are mine. I will never facelift these off, because I earned every single one of them. So
there you
48
go.
And proud.
And that's as my mom says, you know, everyone on the show loves my mom. She's 81 years old. She says, I don't care if people ask my age, as long as they don't ask my weight. So
yeah,
that's
okay,
how
kind of
she throws it down. So, Bill, you were going to say?
Yeah, I'm at 57. I have hair color, which means I have hair.
So. Outstanding.
But it's gray.
There you go. Awesome. Well, and I came about this idea as I was cleaning out my garage last weekend and opened up a tub of memorabilia from high school, from college, different things from my experience in marching band, from stuff, old certificates that I'd gotten for different things, different awards, including an award in, I think it was about second or third grade for 2 weeks good behavior. So apparently I'd made it 2 weeks and that was worthy of an award. So
and
I'm
that
not
was
sure
the
what
last
that,
time, I
that,
think, wasn't
I
it?
I think it was the only time, yeah. So that was a little questionable. But there was so much as I waded through that stuff where I was like, I don't even remember this. I don't even, and I remembered it as I looked at it as something that was so important to me or so life-changing or so, it just, you know, moved the world for me. And I'm like, my goodness, that was so inconsequential now that I look back at it. And so I thought we would bring some folks in the studio and launch into this topic. So who wants to start? I had thrown this out to you guys on the front end just saying, okay, what do you guys think? What are just some words of advice or just things as you look back that you could share with yourself and thus our audience as just life lessons learned or things that you would tell yourself looking back now?
When you mentioned this to me yesterday, the first thing that came to my mind was I would send a note back to myself and say, mullet, bad idea, would be the first thing that
you
I
know what?
Did.
We would have all sent you that same note.
Yeah. We would have.
Definitely. I think that's the reason I've lost all my hair, because I was rocking the mullet for a while. The second thing that I thought of was I would thank my former self for, in the 80s, beginning to wear a pinky ring. Because as you know, I'm still rocking the pinky ring in 2010. So those were the first two things that came to mind. And there are some deeper thoughts, but I'll share those for later in the conversation.
On the non-deeper thoughts, I thought I would write myself a note and say, "Dear me, pay attention next time." Okay, just pay attention next time. I did not pay attention. I did not savor. I did not marinate through much of anything. And I would love to go back. I just had this conversation with some girlfriends saying, I need to take a history class all over again. I need to re-enroll. I need to go skip even high school. I need to go earlier. I need to go back to grade school, elementary school, start history again, because I clearly slept through it. And I want to understand it and embrace it as an adult.
Now I find myself in a position where people are asking me this more and more. I never considered myself a mentor or somebody who people would come to and say, can I just chat with you for a while? Can we just meet for a while? And now I that's my current stage of life. I find that is I'm subtly unprepared for that. And yet I have answers to those kinds of questions. What would I say to myself in years past? It's becoming easier and easier to do that looking back.
Mm-hmm. And so what would be a great example, Bill, as you know, if you were sitting there at 22 years old, would you have envisioned yourself now and had those lessons learned, or, you know, would you have done anything differently?
Yeah, I sure would. I'd write myself. And, you know, I grew up in a Christian home, and that's a blessing. Family took me to church whether or not I wanted to go. They answered my questions whether or not they were the right ones to ask. They brought me up gently in the Christian faith, and I was saved at an early age. I was positionally saved. Jesus Christ took my rightful place on the cross. I should have been there, but as it was, Christ took my place on the cross. At age 11, I knew him. But as is the case with so many people who grow up in a Christian home, I hadn't really realized that Jesus really wanted an experiential relationship with me as well, a growing spiritual relationship, one that I really didn't discover until after college. Writing back, I would say, in college, sit down with some people, some great spiritual minds, discover the Leroy Imes or the Lawrence Sannies of my military association with the Navigators back when I was a cadet, or just to explore the great minds, the deep things as a 20-something with perhaps the Robbie Zachariases or other great theologians, later the Oz Guinnesses or others who influenced my life so well, the Francis Schaeffers. If I could have just connected with somebody like that and just talked about the great things matter spiritual, that growth would have occurred in me much sooner. How might God have used me there for differently, especially considering what I know now? Just to explore the deep things of matters spiritual with the great minds, much like Tevye and Fiddler on the Roof. Mm-hmm. It would have been just great for him, he said, if he could have just sat down with the holy men and just discussed the scriptures and the holy books.
Yeah, I think I had my experience was similar, Bill. I grew up in a Christian home, and I think I always had this impression that was erroneous, and I don't know where I got it, because I think my church was relatively solid, but it was that I would just eke along for a certain amount of time, and then when I was an adult and I had arrived, and maybe that included marriage and kids or whatever, then I would be spiritually mature, and then I would actually start doing real things for the Lord. And until then, I just kind of do whatever I need to do and kind of, you know, exist or learn from others, you know, try to be the good Christian and stuff like that. But I think looking back now, I can realize that, wow, there is so much that can be done by those younger generations. And as many people say, you know, they're not the church of tomorrow, they're the church of today. So where would you guys say spiritually, being a good example of that, any lessons learned?
You know, while Bill was talking, I didn't recognize half the people he just mentioned because I wasn't paying attention during those years. But it does make me think I would have paid attention to those around me in everyday life, my grandmothers, my aunts, my friends' parents. And I really wish I could go back and sort of assess with more clarity what was making life fun in their house, and what was making life work in their house, and what was destroying our families back then? You know, mm-hmm. what are some of those things? Now, in hindsight, I look back and try to pick it apart, and I wish I could sit down with my grandmothers and great-grandmothers and, like I said, the aunts. They are gone, and I feel like I've missed those opportunities. So that would be one thing I would just say. I would love to say to anyone right now, you, like you said, Lisa, you think you have time. You think that's not this season. Mm-hmm. It is this season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
You know, for our listeners, there are people out there that speak into their lives. They're shouting, really, mm-hmm. into their lives. And people just want to hear from mm-hmm. those kinds of folks. They just don't know how to listen. Just take some time and find someone who has spoken into your life and spend some time with them just to go over where they've been, their journey. What is their story? And I think there's great richness there.
Yeah.
Listening. I failed study hall. Did anyone else on this panel fail study hall?
No, I didn't even take study hall because I was too busy taking AP math classes, which I could barely even get through and which has served me no purpose in my life. That's one thing. I remember taking AP calculus. It could have been, for me, Algebra 1 and Calculus were the same difficulty level, meaning I did not understand them and I did not know how to apply them. And I remember our last day before we took the AP exam, we had to watch Stand and Deliver. And at some point, I need to watch that movie and reclaim it because I burst into tears. I am like, here are these East LA kids. They don't even have air conditioning or pencils and they are passing the exam and I can't even figure out what I'm doing. I was just a disaster and I just bawled. Ugh. Yeah.
I would say, as someone who did not grow up in a Christian home, the thing that I wish I could have told myself is to embrace boundaries. And by that, I don't mean, you know, sort of the relational boundaries of the, you know, the book that's very famous, but personal, moral, behavioral boundaries. I was allowed as a child to grow up like a wild weed. I later embraced being a wild weed, and there are consequences that I still deal with from the actions that I had, be that in sexual relationships, to be honest, before I came to Christ, in the way that I treated people, broken relationships, those kinds of things leave scars, leave wounds that I was amazed when I got saved in 1997, just how quickly and how warmly and how excitedly I took to the boundaries that Christianity provided in terms of behavior, in terms of belief, in terms of those things. I had never had them. So it was nice to know that there is right and wrong. It was nice to be able to, it was restful to be able to say, no, that's a bridge too far. And, I still, to this day, bear the scars of the fact that I didn't have those as I was growing up. So that would be even something, for folks who might be listening who aren't Christians, because mm-hmm. there are folks who certainly plug into Boundless who are not Christians. You know, folks, it doesn't have to be rooted in Christianity, but any just common sense, right and wrong, good sorts of boundaries. Try to establish them and stay within them, because I'm 45 years old and I'm still broken in some ways by the behaviors I did when I was 21 years old. One of the phrases that keeps coming to me lately is there are days I'm saved, but there are days I feel like I'm 10,000 shards in a world without glue, that there's still these broken parts of me that need to be healed, and that impedes forward progress to some extent. So that would be the number one thing I would wish upon myself, that either I would heed the advice of someone who said, put some boundaries around yourself, or that someone would impose those on me, because I've certainly missed out on it.
Mm-hmm. I thought you were throwing a prop out to Lisa and the team embracing Boundless. I thought that's perfect, Gary.
Were we around at that time, we would have hoped that Gary would have found us.
Yes.
So I, it's interesting because, we're touching a little bit on relationships here. And one of the things, I lost my dad in 2001, actually the week of 9/11, to cancer. And one of the things when I look back is I wish I had not argued with him throughout junior high and high school about the most stupid things. I argued with him for 8 years about Christian rock and whether or not I should be able to listen to it and whatever. We just would get in these petty arguments, and you know, I accused him of exasperating me, and he accused me of being rebellious and talking back too much and whatever. And we would get into these circular arguments that never went anywhere, were not helpful at all. And, you know, to the point of, you know, and then he would tell me to put a coat on, and I didn't want to put a coat on when I walked out. And then it would just be this big argument about it. And just the wasted time in arguing about petty things would be another thing that I definitely recall.
So knowing your taste in music, mm-hmm. it was your dad who was pro-Christian rock?
No, anti.
Because I know everybody at Boundless knows how much Lisa loves the Gaithers. So I'd be surprised that you would be pro-Christian
rock. Well, and that's what's so ridiculous. See, I used to just say my taste is very eclectic, and so I'm just embracing it all. So now, but he did go to be with the Lord before I really embraced hip-hop, and so we never had to, you know, die on that field.
That's probably a good thing. Yeah, probably why the Lord went ahead and brought him home.
Hallelujah.
Because now he's probably stomping up there to a beat. I mean, who knows? Now we see but a poor reflection, but now he's up there, so he knows the truth. So that's good. But other tips?
One of the things that I find myself saying a lot to women, as well as to young women my daughter's age. I have twin daughters that are 23, and we hang out a lot with their girlfriends and everything. But it is to really learn the difference between a mountain and a molehill. Mm-hmm. Truly. To let molehills be molehills. I mean, we live here in the beautiful land of Pikes Peak and Colorado, Rocky Mountains. And, you know, we'll just look up and say, okay, now that is a 14er. It has the rights of a 14er. But this little thing that we're talking about right now, like you said, Lisa, it is, in the big picture of things, it is so insignificant, this argument or this bitter root that we're growing here, or this unforgiveness or this thing that we're hanging on to, truly to make a mountain, and a molehill, a molehill.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the interesting things now that I am a Christian is my first year as a Christian, I was, for whatever reason, I was very good about journaling. So I have this book that documents my first year as a believer. And even then, going back and reading some of the things I wrote there as a new believer, I mean, I'll jot in the margins, you know, oh my gosh, how melodramatic. I mean, how self-righteous, how... I think Christians who do journal and have those kind of things, I think it's an interesting opportunity to go back and actually have documented for you some of the things that you have done in the past, and you can bring forward ways to sort of correct that and see the you know, the things that you know, I don't have a lot of documentation. I was doing a lot of the stupid things I did before video cameras were even, small and certainly affordable. Thank you, Jesus. In this day and age of you know, people journaling, and you've got everything you do is captured on video and cameras and those kind of things. There is opportunity, I think, for great reflection down the road. And that's been beneficial to me as I move forward.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes when we have things from God, I think we look for cold feet not to do them. This is something that was very innocuous, it seemed at the time, but I was given a business trip to go to Hawaii. We were in Okinawa at the time. This was going to headquarters, and it was going to be relatively easy for me to take my bride along. We'd been married 9 years, had two young kids, but we weren't near family. We had friends, certainly, in the squadron there on the island, and this would be the first time that we were going to be able to let them stay with friends. And it seemed too good to be true. This was going to be wonderful, a wonderful time. And yet, as time came close to go, I think we both kind of looked for cold feet, trying to figure out how not to leave the kids, because that was just going to be a paradigm shift for us, that we weren't exactly going to weather all that well. I think we would have been concerned while we would have been on the trip about the kids, or for whatever reason, we looked for reasons not to have her go with me. After that business trip, I came back and I said, you know, that has to be the worst decision we've made together in 9 years, because it was a wonderful time. I think God had designed, it could have been for us, a time of refreshing that we passed on. I looked at her and I said, you know, there's going to be a time where I get you to Hawaii, I promise you. And it was 16 years later that I finally made good on that promise. And I think at that time, I should have not had cold feet. How we should have gone ahead and taken the Lord's leading on that. And if you're out there and you're listening and you feel like there's something that God's telling you to do, don't look for ways not to do it. Look for ways to get it done. It might be years before He finally blesses you with that, only because of stuff that you did. And looking back, that's something we would have changed.
Hmm. Yeah. What about, let's just talk about relationships, and you are all married at this point. Any things heading into marriage or now in your marriages that you would look back on and have words of wisdom for your former self? I know I tend to be I refer to myself as a little bit of the cautionary tale here for Boundless folks, as far as believing that when I got out of college, a Christian college, no less, for which I paid an inordinate amount, I thought for sure I would be married coming out of there, and I wasn't. And one day woke up and I was 30, and I was like, what in the world happened? And I think I could have done a lot better at honoring marriage in my own life and recognizing it as something that is to be prayed about and is to be pursued diligently and be open to, and not let, you know, career or other aspirations kind of trump that in many ways. But how about you all?
You know, I have to just jump in. One of the things that Dr. Julie Slattery and I do on our show on Wednesdays, Your Family Live, is we represent, one, our personalities, which are polar opposites. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you've ever watched the show, you know we are polar opposites. And Julie is a planner. Julie and her husband, Mike, went into their marriage having a verse, a life verse, a mission statement. Mm-hmm. They had their top 100 things that we want to do as a married couple, thus as a family, planned, prayed over, I'm sure, Bible studies on that years before they ever, you know, crossed the line to say, I do. I, before coming to Christ, give that as a little disclaimer, but my husband and I stood at the altar. I was 4.5 months pregnant with twins. We sort of went into this going, I'll give it 3 years. And he said, I'll give it 5, to which I was elated. I thought, wow, that's 2 more years than what I was going to give this thing. And so just to show you the polar opposites. But having said that, certainly not as an endorsement to anyone listening, but God's grace, God's mercies, even if we are not entering into the relationship, the marriage, our futures with all the plans worked out in a nice and tidy box with the bow on top. I would say to anybody right now, my husband and I have worked so hard at our marriage, and we continue to work so hard at our marriage, not because we have all the chapter and verses now as we both stand here as Christians, as a couple, but because we are very intentional about this, but we are also very forgiving. We are very, you know, aware of, again, just, I came to this as a sinner, you came to this as a sinner, and it is only by God's grace that we still stand here and communicate and even like each other, much less love each other, and then passing that along to our kids. So I give that sort of out there as a, again, not as a disclaimer, not to plan. You know, if Julie were here, she'd smack me. But just to say, planning is good, but sometimes life is happening while we're planning it.
Mm-hmm. I would say, in terms of my marriage, that if I could talk to the pre-married me, which would have been 11 years ago, to have more reasonable expectations of what marriage was going to be. We did the premarital counseling, we did all those things, and yet there's part of me, especially since I was a relatively new Christian about 3 years into it, there was part of me that just kind of, you know, was like, everything's going to be sunshine and roses, and we're going to float by on clouds and never bump into each other. And, you know, it's all going to be perfect. And it's not to say things aren't good. It's just, as Yvette said, there's work that has to be done. And I don't know that I knew going in that there was going to be so much effort that needed to be exerted for us to continue to grow together. Because it's really easy to, once you're married, to sort of get into a drifting pattern where you're just kind of coasting along and you're not working at it. And next thing you know, you've drifted apart. And that intentionality, I don't think, frankly, I don't think if I'd have told myself 10 years ago you need to do this, I would have done it because I was all caught up in them. There are people who told me those kind of things, and I don't know that I paid attention to them. So even if I wrote a letter to myself, I'd probably dismiss my, you know, old Gary, you know, a younger Gary would sort of dismiss older Gary's advice because you're kind of caught up in that moment. But the thing is, the great thing that has been there, I tell people all the time that since we've been married, if we were just dating, there's probably 10 times in the course of those 11 years that we probably would have broken up if we were just dating. But having that commitment that sealed us together made it something that we worked at. So hold on to that, absolutely. But also go into it, you know, with reasonable expectations. As Bill was saying earlier, find a mentor, find couples you can talk to. One of the greatest things, and I didn't realize how great it was when it happened, but in our premarital counseling, my wife and I had a huge fight, of course, on the way to premarital counseling. And we went to our pastor's houses and our house, and we sat down on the couch as far away from each other as we possibly could. And we were just incredibly angry with each other. And Carla, my wife, then stacked up all the chairs on the big fluffy couch. I mean, all the cushions on the big fluffy couch in between us, so she wouldn't have to even look at me, because there was, like, you know, 7 foot of cushion between us. And we just thought it was the end. Mm-hmm. And our pastors walked out and they saw the scene. And the wife said to the husband, "Oh, go get the camera. We got to get a picture of this." And it was great because it showed us that what we thought was the end of the world was, in fact, not. And that's a good perspective that you're to carry through. Yes, you have to be prepared. You have to have reasonable expectations. But the things that you think are so big on Monday, on Wednesday, if you work through it and, you know, with God as your guide, aren't that big of a deal.
Was it a molehill?
Yes.
What put you between the other and the cushions?
The cushions was a, you know, were a mountain. Okay. But the problem was a molehill. Absolutely.
Good.
Nice. All right. Well, just final thoughts here as kind of we're wrapping up. I just thought I'd throw it out there in case anyone wanted to walk through a few more bullet points, like things that they just didn't get to say. Like I thought for myself, things I was going to say, exercise. Like I kind of went through many seasons where I didn't really exercise, and now I run, and I'm just kind of like, wow, I wish I would have run in my 20s, you know, or whatever, and just kind of very willy-nilly about that. Dealing with stress appropriately, especially during the time when my dad died, and we were going through a lot of stuff here at Focus on the Family and at work, and out of all that, I had a doctor's appointment, and he basically told me, you know what, now you have rheumatoid arthritis, and stress probably contributed to that. And so just something to remember there. Start thinking about your career prior to graduation day. I did not do that. And I basically went out into the world and I'm like, what do I start doing now with my life? I have a degree and I don't know what to do. And I was so caught up in college and all the activities that I didn't think about that. And so I floundered for a while for sure. And then the other one is to definitely take fashion advice from others, because I didn't find my fashion self until about 6 or 7 years ago. And when I look back on photos, I'm just devastated. And I'm like, wow, I should have maybe asked for some opinions here, because there was some not good stuff going on with that. So just a funny one there. But anything else? Last minute words?
You know, at my age, at 57, looking back, there's a lot of things I just don't care what people think anymore.
Amen.
About me.
Mm-hmm.
Let
me just shout out.
And it just doesn't matter. I mean, some of the things that that I do or say, it just doesn't matter what other people, as long as God is pleased, as long as God is glorified, that's fine with me. And you know what? That is contentment. And it's what a lot of people are searching for. And that's where it is. I just pass that on.
That's what I call my Jimmy Crack Corn song. That's just Jimmy Crack Corn. You know what? I'm sorry, but
that's right.
Yeah.
I'm not sure this audience has ever heard that song.
Yeah, okay, look it up. No, you can Google
sing
it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If that's from Kentucky, so
there
a
is
shout
a tune
to our Kentucky
associated.
Listeners.
That's yeah. Exactly right. One thing, I, at this stage of the game, I can hide my own Easter eggs. I cannot remember, seriously. I go out every night to the parking lot and go, gee, where, it's a new fun game every day. Where's my car? I wish that I would have written down my prayer requests and answered prayer through my life with the Lord, because there's so many and I haven't savored them appropriately. So I would say that.
Mm-hmm. I have three. Hopefully
we'll let you say three.
Okay, good, because I don't want to be in the 30-second zone. One would be the first time I ever picked up a drink to put it down, I would tell myself. That was a big struggle that ended for me in 1997, but lots of of damage, not only to myself, which is perhaps least important, but to people around me that I wish I could take back. Secondly, do not define yourself by what you do, because that is a barnacle that will stick to you and is hard to pry off. If that's where you you draw your identity, especially as a man, it's very, very difficult not to see yourself as that. It struck me recently as my wife and I have walked through some challenges that, you know, you're in a party and you meet somebody and, it's, you know, the first thing you ask is, what do you do? Not what you believe, who are you, what are, you know, we all have professional resumes. How many of us have life resumes? That's much more important than our jobs in the end. And then the last thing that is perhaps the most important advice I would give myself, you know, young Gary, that old Gary would give young Gary is, buy the domain name Facebook.com. Because Mark Zuckerberg would have had to pay me a lot of money if I would have jumped on that and I would have known it was coming. So
you would have. My goodness. So, but maybe, I mean, you practically own it at this point anyway, just from sheer
yes.
From sheer usage.
Yes.
If that were the, you know.
Yeah. Now, I don't have a, but who here among us, there's four of us sitting here behind the glass, who among us has a fan page on Facebook? Bill?
I don't think so.
No, Yvette?
Negative.
I don't have one. Lisa Anderson has her own fan
there
page.
There you go.
I rest my case.
Well, telling you.
I don't know what I could tell my younger self about that, because that's just from out of the blue. Don't know quite what to do with that, but it's good times. So it's been very, very fun. And that's definitely, I mean, my involvement with Boundless and the Boundless Show is something that I never could have predicted. And it's really been neat to see how, and there we go, my cautionary tale, whatever. Maybe I'm single because I now host the show and I'm just, you know, still, it's not that God doesn't use the seasons of life that we have, you know, and he doesn't waste anything. And it's not, you know, I love where I am now. I love my friends and I certainly love everyone out there, as well as our panel, because you guys all are just fabulous. And I'm so glad I know you. So,
wow, group hug time or something. I don't know if there's enough room back here behind
group hug,
the
and then I'll have
class.
Dave run a Gaither track under it. There you go.
Yeah, okay. So,
thank you all so much for sharing. I think this was fantastic.
Our pleasure.
Thanks, Lisa.
Duty, honor, country. Those three hallowed words reverently dictate what you ought to be, what you can be, what you will be. They are your rallying points, to build courage when courage seems to fail, to regain faith when there seems to be little cause for faith, to create hope when hope becomes forlorn. Unhappily, I possess neither that eloquence of diction, that brilliance of metaphor to tell you all that they mean. The unbelievers will say that they are but words, but a slogan, but a flamboyant phrase. Every pedant, every demagogue, every cynic, every hypocrite, every troublemaker, and I am sorry to say some others of an entirely different character, will try to downgrade them even to the extent of mockery and ridicule. But these are some of the things they do. They build your basic character. They mold you for your future roles as the custodians of the nation's defense. They make you strong enough to know when you are weak and brave enough to face yourself when you are afraid. They teach you to be proud and unbending in honest failure, but humble and gentle in success. Not to substitute words for action, not to seek the path of comfort, but to face the stress and spur of difficulty and challenge. To learn to stand up in the storm, but to have compassion on those who fall. To master yourself before you seek to master others. To have a heart that is clean, a goal that is high. To learn to laugh, yet never forget how to weep. To reach into the future, yet never neglect the past. To be serious, yet never take yourself too seriously. To be modest so that you will remember the simplicity of true greatness. The open mind of true wisdom. The meekness of true strength. They give you a temperate will, a quality of imagination, a vigor of the emotions, a freshness of the deep springs of life, a temperamental predominance of courage over timidity, an appetite for adventure over love of ease. They create in your heart the sense of wonder, the unfailing hope of what next, and the joy and inspiration of life. They teach you in this way to be an officer and a gentleman. And what sort of soldiers are those you are to lead? Are they reliable? Are they brave? Are they capable of victory? Their story is known to all of you. It is the story of the American man at arms. My estimate of him was formed on the battlefields many, many years ago and has never changed. I regarded him then, as I regard him now, as one of the world's noblest figures, not only as one of the finest military characters, but also as one of the most stainless. His name and fame are the birthright of every American citizen. In his youth and strength, his love and loyalty, he gave all that mortality can give. He needs no eulogy from me or from any other man. He has written his own history and written it in red on his enemy's breast. But when I think of his patience under adversity, of his courage under fire, and of his modesty in victory, I am filled with an emotion of admiration I cannot put into words. He belongs to history as furnishing one of the greatest examples of successful patriotism. He belongs to posterity as the instructor of future generations in the principles of liberty and freedom. He belongs to the present, to us, by his virtues and by his achievements. In 20 campaigns on 100 battlefields, around 1,000 campfires, I have witnessed that enduring fortitude, that patriotic self-abnegation, and that invincible determination which have carved his statue in the hearts of his people. From one end of the world to the other, he has drained deep the chalice of courage. As I listened to those songs of the Glee Club, in memory's eye I could see those staggering columns of the First World War, bending under soggy packs on many a weary march, from dripping dust to drizzling dawn, slogging ankle deep through mire of shell-pocked roads, to form grimly for the attack, blue-lipped, covered with sludge and mud, chilled by the wind and rain, driving home to their objective and, for many, to the judgment seat of God. I do not know the dignity of their birth, but I do know the glory of their death. They died unquestioning, uncomplaining, with faith in their hearts and on their lips the hope that we would go on to victory. Always for them, duty, honor, country. Always their blood and sweat and tears as they saw the way and the light. And 20 years after, on the other side of the globe, against the filth of dirty foxholes, the stench of ghostly trenches, the slime of dripping dugouts, those boiling suns of the relentless heat, those torrential rains of devastating storms, the loneliness and utter desolation of jungle trails, the bitterness of long separation from those they loved and cherished, the deadly pestilence of tropic disease, the horror of stricken areas of war. Their resolute and determined defense, their swift and sure attack, their indomitable purpose, their complete and decisive victory. Always victory, always through the bloody haze of their last reverberating shot, the vision of gaunt, ghastly men reverently following the password of duty, honor, country. The code which those words perpetuate embraces the highest moral laws and will stand the test of any ethics or philosophies ever promulgated for the uplift of mankind. Its requirements are for the things that are right, and its restraints are from the things that are wrong. The soldier, above all other men, is required to practice the greatest act of religious training, sacrifice. In battle and in the face of danger and death, he discloses those divine attributes which his Maker gave when he created man in his own image. No physical courage and no brute instinct can take the place of the divine help which alone can sustain him. However horrible the incidents of war may be, the soldier who is called upon to offer and to give his life for his country is the noblest development of mankind. And through all this, your mission remains fixed, determined, inviolable. It is to win our wars. Everything else in your professional career is but corollary to this vital dedication. All other public purpose, all other public projects, all other public needs, great or small, will find others for their accomplishments. But you are the ones who are trained to fight. Yours is the profession of arms, the will to win, the sure knowledge that in war there is no substitute for victory, that if you lose, the nation will be destroyed, that the very obsession of your public service must be duty, honor, country. Others will debate the controversial issues, national and international, which divide men's minds. But serene, calm, aloof, you stand as the nation's war guardians, as its lifeguards from the raging tides of international conflict, as its gladiators in the arena of battle. For a century and a half, you have defended, guarded, and protected its hallowed traditions of liberty and freedom, of right and justice. Let civilian voices argue the merits or demerits of our processes of government, whether our strength is being sapped by deficit financing indulged in too long, by federal paternalism grown too mighty, by power groups grown too arrogant, by politics grown too corrupt, by crime grown too rampant, by morals grown too low, by taxes grown too high, by extremists grown too violent, whether our personal liberties are as firm and complete as they should be. These great national problems are not for your professional participation or military solution. Your guidepost stands out like a tenfold beacon in the night. Duty, honor, country. You are the leaven which binds together the entire fabric of our national system of defense. From your ranks comes the great captains who hold the nation's destiny in their hands the moment the war tocsin sounds. The long gray line has never failed us. Were you to do so, a million ghosts in olive drab, in brown khaki, in blue and gray, would rise from their white crosses, thundering those magic words, duty, honor, country. This does not mean that you are warmongers. On the contrary, the soldier, above all other people, prays for peace, for he must suffer and bear the deepest wounds and scars of war. But always in our ears ring the ominous words of Plato, that wisest of all philosophers, only the dead have seen the end of war. The shadows are lengthening for me, the twilight is here. My days of old have vanished, tone and tints. They have gone glimmering through the dreams of things that were. Their memory is one of the wondrous beauty, watered by tears and coaxed and caressed by the smiles of yesterday. I listened then, but with thirsty ear, for the witching melody of faint bugles blowing reveille, of far drums beating the long roll. In my dreams I hear again the crash of guns, the rattle of musketry, the strange mournful mutter of the battlefield. But in the evening of my memory I come back to West Point, always there echoes and re-echoes, duty, honor, country. Today marks my final roll call with you, but I want you to know that when I cross the river, my last conscious thoughts will be of the Corps and the Corps and the Corps. I bid you farewell.
Well, hey, everyone. We are opening up this week's inbox, and I am joined by Wade Brown here in the studio. Wade, welcome.
Good to be here, Lisa.
Yay. Many of you remember Wade was here when we talked about Clergy Appreciation Month and just young adults working with pastors within the church and encouragement for that. So it's good to have you back because we felt we had to marshal your expertise on
there
this question.
Well, thank you.
That we have. So Wade is part of our pastoral ministries department here at Focus on the Family and is a former pastor as well as involvement in the military. And so you've been out and about quite a bit throughout your career. Well, here, I'm going to throw this one at you. This is from a guy who has a very good question that needs your wisdom. So here we go. He says, in the last few months, I've begun pursuing a romantic relationship with a woman I've known for over a decade. I do have one rather significant reservation about the future of our relationship. We come from two different denominational backgrounds. There are several commonalities between the two, but they differ on some key ideas, like baptism, church structure, and approach to corporate worship. Complicating things is the fact that I feel a clear call on my life to step into full-time pastoral ministry within my denomination. Growing up in church, we're told to make sure the person we marry is a believer in Jesus, but what if that's not enough? What if our core doctrinal convictions are consistent, but the secondary ones are still in conflict? Is there a possible way to resolve this, or should I consider breaking off this relationship and pursuing someone within my own specific denominational background?
Wow, that is a great question, Lisa. And if you don't mind, I'm going to step out and go get an expert to answer this.
Exactly.
I don't know the age of the person who sent in this question, but first just want to say congratulations on that call into vocational ministry. That's a pretty cool thing. But, you know, as I think about the question and some elements from your story here, you know, some things are very encouraging to me. I want to highlight a few of those. First, you're talking about an intra-faith issue, and many couples obviously deal with this. They are of the same worldview in this case. We're talking a biblical theistic worldview, but come from two denominational backgrounds, as opposed to an interfaith issue where we'd be talking, of course, about two different worldviews, and that would complicate
things. Where we'd be saying, shut it down.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then secondly, it sounds like you're both deeply committed to Christ, and kudos on that. That is most important. And then thirdly, you are grappling with an issue here that many couples wait until they are married to deal with it, and especially after they have their first child. And so this is huge that you're talking about this right now, and you're not waiting until, as you say, you have an eye towards the future. We're assuming that that means marriage, and it could mean that in God's economy. So you're grappling with this right now. And then fourthly, it sounds like your core convictions are, you're unified in that. So again, be encouraged. This could be much more complicated than it seems. So as you progress in this relationship and this very important question that you are grappling with right now, here are a few thoughts to consider. First is in the form of a question. And I'm assuming you've had some dialogue with your significant other, your girlfriend, about this clear call on your life to go into vocational ministry one day. And my question for you is, how does she resonate with that? I realize it's early, but if that scares her to death, which would be a kind of a natural feeling, perhaps it scares you to death right now, but if that is something that she is just flatly opposed to, we can simplify this very quickly and say, I think you have your answer. Mm-hmm. And I think in so many ways she has her answer. And believe it or not, with God, it is a win-win scenario. So if you do sense a clear call on your life for vocational ministry within your congregation, and she's flatly opposed, she wants to run the other direction, perhaps it would be time to talk about ending the relationship, at least at the level that you're moving towards. But if she is open to the idea of you going into vocational ministry, there has to be a level of compromise. And especially if you are looking towards marriage, and the compromise is going to be, realistically, practically speaking, more about her compromising, in this relationship, because you, if you're called to be a preacher, teacher, work with students, I don't know what that call could look like in your life one day. Obviously, that means you cannot pick up and leave anytime you want to, but there will be, believe it or not, days off and weekends off. And so if I were you, I would encourage your perhaps future wife to visit, to maintain those ties that she has with her denominational background. And there would be, again, weekends off where you could go with her, because that's important to her. That also should be very important to you in a relationship. You know, Jesus, and maybe this is the most important point I want you to consider in this for you and your girlfriend. Jesus in Matthew 19:5 reiterated some words from the Old Testament, initially found in Genesis 2:24. But Jesus has this to say, "For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh." And that's not talking about just in a physical sense one day when you're married, but it's also talking about spiritually, emotionally, and everything else that goes into being a married couple. So with that, know that while your parents, the decision that you are about to make perhaps about denominational flavors and all that, your parents are going to be concerned about that. And maybe especially her parents would be concerned about that. But ultimately, this is your decision as a couple before God. And as discontent as your parents may be over this, you and your girlfriend, perhaps your wife one day, this has to be a decision that you two live with. And you have to be at peace with it before the Father.
Yeah. I think it's significant to note, too, because he had given some specific examples here of style of worship and stuff. I mean, I think there's a difference between, who wants to raise hands and who doesn't.
Absolutely.
Versus, what people are comfortable with maybe if he is going to be a pastor in a certain denomination. And like he said, the views on baptism differ. That's going to be something that probably is a little bit more of a concern, because
for sure,
as they have children, You can't run to this church down the street and be like, anyway, we're going to do this.
We'll be back in a little bit.
That's just kind of weird. So, but I liked what you said about really bringing this to the table with her, Wade, because there are a lot of compromises that she'll be called to take on if she goes into marriage, because her husband needs to lead, and especially if he's a leader in ministry as well as within the home. Mm-hmm. You know, you like you said, she needs to decide what she can live with and what she can't, and what she can support,
not only
in him as a husband, but in him as a pastor.
Yeah, so I think that's very good, Lisa. And you need to be clear that clear on those issues on this side of the fence.
Yeah.
You know, I have met and counseled personally with many pastors' wives over the years who were very reticent to get into that kind of relationship, knowing that their boyfriend at the time had this clear call on his life or vocational ministry, but decided to move forward anyway, but apprehensively. Mm-hmm. And honestly, in simple terms, very bitter today as a result of that. Mm-hmm. And I don't think God arranges it that way. And of course, God can change hearts. But maybe on this side of the fence, it wasn't meant to be. That relationship wasn't meant to be taken to that level as well. So, again, kudos that you're dealing with it right now. That's huge.
Yeah, that's good. Well, and I think, too, you know, just finding some other guys who are within your denomination, maybe others who have dealt with this as well, who can provide some insight into that. What are the negotiables? What aren't negotiable?
Very good.
Get some good practical insight into that. And I think that will help you as well. So thanks, Wade, so
you're
much
welcome.
For helping weigh in on this. That's great. Well, that is it for this week's show, everyone. As always, we want to hear from you. Write to us, editor@boundless.org, with your question or your comment on this question. If you have any experience in that or any follow-ups or anything that you would like to see us address in the future, we would love to do that. In the meantime, keep listening. I'm Lisa Anderson, your host for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of boundless.org. Focus on the family.